This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow with a question. Just what does it mean to be a Southerner? Historically, every time we thought we had an answer, we've had to revise our ideas. As the economics, politics, and very inhabitants of the South change, what happens to the culture and the identity of this region? Many of us in North Carolina have witnessed this directly. For a decade, this state received more immigrants than any other state in the country. How has this changed the Piedmont? How are native North Carolinians taking it? What's the impact on the immigrants who come here? Tracy Thompson is the author of The New Mind of the South, and she's with me today. Tracy Thompson, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me here.
Before we talk about immigration, I want to get to this idea of Southern regional identity, because perhaps there is no regional identity that is as strongly defined and we think as well understood as that. And yet it's really always been in flux, hasn't it?
Yes, it really has. And, of course, there's many Souths. There's no such thing as the South. But the South has been a region that has known more wrenching social change, I would argue, than any other part of the country. And yet it has this self-image as being a region that is very resistant to change. So it's kind of this weird cognitive dissonance we have going on.
And probably closely related, people under stress, people whose identities have been changed by outside forces are probably more tenacious with regard to that identity than others, perhaps, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. There's a quote that I use in my book from the poet John Crow Ransom, who said, "Nostalgia is the complaint of human nature when it is plucked up by the roots." And I think that really sums it up. You have this intense longing for something that you remember from your past that is disappearing before your eyes.
And it's so fascinating because we've been in a process of reconstituting and re-envisioning our past down here. The first story, the post-Reconstruction story of the South, is the story of white men who've had to somehow redeem their treason and their dependence on slave labor. And so they come up with this noble lost cause ethos. And then John Hope Franklin comes along and says, remember, there were black people here. Let's tell their story. Anne Firor Scott says, don't forget, women played a much different role. And so we rewrite the story. And now you're saying, in fact, we have to look at the present and say, once we think we finally got it, there's this wave of immigration that changes our story again.
Yeah, and that's the really fascinating thing. The Hispanics that are making the South their home these days are changing the South, and I think the South is changing them. And it's a kind of an untold story yet how this is all going to work out. But the interesting thing to me is how at home they feel in the South, because it's a conservative region. It's a very family-oriented region. Parts of it are still very agrarian. It's very much like, and it's a very religious society still. And this is a whole lot like the part of Mexico. Most of these immigrants are Mexicans, at least in North Carolina, that they came from. And so it feels very much at home to them.
And as you point out, many of the immigrants, the vast majority, are coming here from rural regions to other rural regions. They're engaged in the same kinds of activities, unlike other immigration to industrial sectors. They're coming here to a rural area, and they're engaged in farming or agricultural activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a police chief in Asheboro, North Carolina, who I talked to, who said that he had gone to the region of central Mexico where an awful lot of the people who live in Asheboro or Randolph County were from, and he was struck by how much it reminded him of his own childhood in North Carolina, growing up as the child of parents who, you know, had a little vegetable farm out back, and it was a similarly mountainous region. It was an area where there were a lot of kind of yeoman farmers, no big, huge industrial agriculture or anything, just a lot of people growing their own crops and farming the land.
So it's interesting with this kind of mutual comfort that people from Mexico and North Carolina feel in each other's territory. Does this mean new immigrants feel Southern?
No, I don't think they do. I was talking to some high school seniors in Asheboro, and I asked them if they felt like they were Southern, and they looked at me like I'd put my pants on my head. They were like, yeah. What do you mean? This is the North to them. And They had no concept of being Southern, and in fact, their stereotype version of being Southern was, you know, fields of cotton and black people in the back part of a bus. And it did not comport with anything they saw around them. So, no, they didn't feel Southern. On the other hand, somehow a mention of Gone with the Wind came up, and I asked if anybody knew that book, and almost every girl in that room raised her hand, and some of the boys, too. They loved that book. That was totally unexpected to me.
Wow. Did you ask them why? What was it about that book, do you think?
We didn't get a chance to talk about it very long, but I just think it was just sort of this sweeping romance,
right.
and there's such a strong connection between Southern literature and Latin American literature. You know, Faulkner is a god in Latin America. So I think it was just that. There's something, some sort of cultural affinity that's going on there.
Now, we talk about the stereotypes that new recent immigrants might have about Southerners. What about Southerners when they're faced with new neighbors? How are they taking it?
Well, not all that well. A lot of times there's the usual kind of fear that comes whenever a new immigrant group arrives. And so the Hispanics are getting their turn at this now. But it happened when the Irish came to this country. It happened when the Eastern European Jews came to this country. It happened when my people, the Scots-Irish, came to this country. They were always denigrated as being, poor, unskilled, just not nice folks to have around, and what are we going to do with them? And the Hispanics are getting a version of that. They are, people often assume that they are a drag on the taxpayer, that they are a drag on social services, that they take more than they give, and that they're responsible for high crime rates. There's almost no truth to this. There is some limited truth to the social services argument because when new immigrants come in and they have kids, those kids need to go to school, and it's in the community's interest to educate them. And yet, in the short term, yeah, they are costing the county money. But in the long term, in the broader scheme of things, they almost always end up contributing more to the economy than they take from it.
Well, and that's the difficult thing, isn't it? Any kind of social change like this, all that is visible tends to be all that occupies the mind. So your thoughts center on what you can see and not what you can understand about the impact on the economy. Why are these folks here? Who would be doing
right.
this work otherwise? What would it cost us if, you know, all of those kinds of questions aren't visible when you go to the supermarket and someone's trying to make a transaction in two languages?
Right. Right.
And also, you're talking about people sort of looking for or being confirmed in their prejudice when they see, you know, for instance, a cop might arrest somebody for a crime and they're Hispanic, and there you go. That's the reason the crime rate is high, right?
Yeah, it's a classic case of confirmation bias. You know, once you start looking for something, you tend to see examples of it everywhere. But in fact, when you look at crime statistics. And this was, again, the police chief in Ashboro that I was talking to, a guy named Ralph Norton. He said it was not – his impression was that there were no more arrests in the areas of town that were Hispanic populated than there were in other parts of town. Just recently, there had been a car accident with a drunk driver who was Hispanic that had caused a lot of community outrage. But on the whole, he said, they don't commit crimes any more than native North Carolinians do. And in fact, they tend not to call the police as much because they have, if they came here illegally, of course, they're probably not going to want to interact with officialdom any more than they have to. So if anything, he said they're more apt to be victims of crime,
now,
particularly things like domestic abuse and that sort of thing.
And you're right about the fact that we're calling this new immigration, and it started over the past 10 or 15 years or so, maybe 20 years. And it's interesting because really since the 18th century, immigrants have not migrated to the South. Why not?
Well, there were several reasons. One was that the South was such an agrarian region. And when you have slaves, you don't need even cheap labor because you have free labor. And so The immigrants who came to this country, starting in like the mid-19th century when the Irish potato famine, for instance, sent lots of folks to these shores, they tended to go to the industrial centers in the north where they found work. And the South was just, it didn't need their kind of labor. We didn't have the major industries that would have supported that kind of labor. And we didn't have the rail infrastructure and the roads and that sort of thing that was being built in the North. So for an awful long time, and I'm talking about up through my childhood in the 1960s, the South was the most homogeneous region of the country. I mean, there were black Southerners and there were white Southerners, and that was pretty much it.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about the changes that new immigration is bringing to the South and other questions that surround this bigger issue of Southern identity when our conversation continues with Tracy Thompson, author of the book The New Mind of the South, and we'll be joined by Hodding Carter III, who is a professor of leadership at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and today we're talking about the changing South. Tracy Thompson's author of The New Mind of the South, and while Tracy was writing that book, she consulted with many historians and writers, among them Hodding Carter III, who is a professor of leadership and public policy at UNC Chapel Hill, and he joins us now. Welcome. Good to have you back.
It's great to be here. Great to be with Tracy.
I'm going to put another question to Tracy, because I know, Tracy, when you started writing this book, you discovered that there was a relative of yours who was a Union, who fought for the Union, a Union supporter during the Civil War, and this got you thinking about how you understood your own history. But first, tell us about your discovery.
Well, it wasn't my discovery. Actually, it was a cousin who was doing some research on the Thompson family history, and he found a whole file on this common ancestor in something called the Southern Claims Commission papers at the National Archives. And this ancestor hadn't actually fought for the Union, although he had tried to. He lived in Atlanta, and just south of Atlanta, and he refused to fight for the Confederacy, and he got into an awful lot of trouble with his neighbors over the course of the war over this, and eventually had to leave the state because they were threatening his life. And he left to go back to Randolph County, Alabama, which is where his family was from, and just in time for Sherman to come through and pick his farm clean. So you couldn't catch a break there. But there were actually, I discovered, a significant number of people in his area who were of the same persuasion, who actively resisted fighting for the Confederacy and gave aid and comfort to folks who were trying to escape and cross over to Union lines, and who hid people that the conscript office was looking for and all that sort of stuff. And this was really just directly contrary to everything I had heard growing up about how the South had been this, you know, united front in firm in its support of the Confederacy. It just wasn't like that. It was just a far more complex story.
And even when they did talk about him, apparently, the story was that he was just faking it just to get a better deal from Sherman's army when he did come through, right?
Yeah, you know, if you actually read Gone with the Wind, this isn't in the movie, but there's a part of Gone with the Wind where one of Scarlett's sisters attempts to do this thing where she wants to go to this is after the war, and she goes into the government and tries to get her father to swear that he never supported the Confederacy so she can get money from the government. And apparently this was the standard explanation in Southern society at large whenever this sort of thing came up, that, oh, well, they weren't really Unionists. They were just trying to finagle some money out of the government for damages. But I went to the archives and I read through the entire file of everybody from the county where my ancestor lived, and they weren't kidding. They really were Unionists, and yeah, they really were not fighting for the Confederacy.
Well, and this is the problem, Hodding, isn't it, is that we all have this misunderstanding, in large part because Southerners have been telling themselves this for a long time, and then we take on board the idea of a very simple picture down here. All the white folks supported the Confederacy, and black folk couldn't wait for that to end.
The South was one of the few places where the losers wrote the history, And the losers in this case wrote an entire mythology about the South, which Tracy goes into quite elaborately. Tracy, being that much younger than me, does not aware that Ronald Reagan starred in a movie about the county in Mississippi which seceded from the Confederacy and was reduced by the Confederate Army. It was a Free State of Jones. We grew up knowing about it, and then I saw that idiot movie, and I relearned it and discovered that, of course, it was true. And in most places, there was the Free State of Jones in one way or another in which Unionists. But it didn't really matter. And there's something I wanted to say along this line, and that is today, yesterday, 20 years before, we have done a terrible, terrible disservice to ourselves by lousy history. And when we quit teaching lousy history, we quit teaching history. How many people get to hear from their grandfather, as Jeff Davis proudly said, "I would do it all again," from their grandfather about how he stood nobly in front of the drinking fountain, how he kept a little black child from going to school? We basically try to obliterate that from not only our own family histories, but from the official histories. You notice that my old good buddy Charles Salas, the year behind me in high school in Greenville, Mississippi, and Jim Lewin had written a book about, a real textbook about Southern history, because when you had to take it in Mississippi, what you got was smiling black folks eating watermelon and loving being out in the cotton fields, and that was it. Well, now you hardly teach anything. Certainly, over the last 50 years, like all 50-year history, it practically doesn't exist. I at least had the virtue of being able to go see old Mrs. Ball, who lived behind the hedges, and would explain to me patiently why it was that we didn't celebrate July 4th, because she had been at Vicksburg when it fell on July 4th, and by God, in Mississippi, we did not celebrate it. Come on. Yeah. Tracy, you did not meet a lot of high schoolers who knew very much about Southern history.
No, and I don't meet a lot of high schoolers today who know much about it either. The way this part of Southern history is taught today, it's glossed over.
Yes.
Because there's so much they're trying to cram in there. You get a few triumphalist stories about Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass, and almost nothing about Reconstruction, which is this incredibly important era of Southern history that almost nobody knows the real truth about these days.
And the diversity of opinion down here before, during, and after the Civil War. But also, we're all complicit in this. I want to talk to both of you about this. There's a debate raging in a corner of the blogosphere right now about whether or not the abundance of American military facilities named for Confederate generals should probably, by now, be changing their names. And there are a number of them. These men committed treason in defense of the institution of slavery. Shouldn't we take their names off American military installations? By the mercy of God, they were not executed for their treason, but we probably shouldn't be glorifying them anymore. So we're all complicit in this, aren't we? This sort of restructuring of American history and the role of the American South, honey?
Happily, in Ireland and Scotland, when the Brits put everything to the sword and obliterated much of the past, they recreated it. Look, what do? You pretend that this doesn't exist. You pretend it wasn't central to a region, that these armies and these generals were there. We're having wonderful demonstrations about Silent Sam over at UNC. I fully appreciate the sensibilities and sensitivities on this subject. But you know what? Wiping it out does not change it. And second, wiping it out is another form of madness to go along with the myth of Southern history already. No, the answer is to do better history, not knock out the history that was there.
Well, Tracy, you talk about your own hometown of Atlanta and sort of coming to understand the truth of it. I think maybe it's summed up in your experience at the barbershop, which was staffed by all black personnel. Your father used to go there, and how this kind of picture of courtesy and genteel Southern virtue also glossed over and covered up the real history of the South in Atlanta.
Yeah, and I mean, it was stuff like that that kind of planted the seeds for this book in my mind, even, you know, when I was a kid, because what I saw around me was the vestiges of of Jim Crow, which was in the process of crumbling in the 60s, but it was also kind of held up against the emerging civil rights movement, which, of course, Atlanta was in some ways the epicenter of. And you could not reconcile the story of the South that I knew from my childhood growing up of, you know, benevolent slave owners and happy black people and white people who loved each other. You could not reconcile that with the civil rights movement. They could not both be true. And so kids of my generation, anyway, grew up with this enormous dissonance staring us in the face. And you either just kind of filed it away in your mind and said, well, I'll think about that later, or it just bothered you. And I was one of the people it really, really bothered. But this barbershop really stuck in my mind because it was black-owned and operated. It was very posh. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was one of the barbershops in Atlanta that belonged to Alonzo Herndon, who was one of the first black millionaires in this country. And these guys were, you know, in their spotless white coats. And my dad would come in and they would cater to him. And, you know, when he was done getting his hair cut, they would brush him off and give him a little talcum powder and hand him his coat. And it was all very, very deferential. And at the same time, it was a black-owned barbershop that would not serve black people.
Wow. So, and eventually there were protests, and that's when you sort of had to come to terms with what was really going on over that bar. I mean, that was one of the targets of the sit-ins, right?
Well, I'm not really sure about that part. The barbershop was only a couple of blocks away from Rich's department store, which was a huge object of the black boycott during the early 60s in Atlanta. So I don't know if it was connected with the barbershop, if it got kind of brought into the whole unrest, or if my dad just figured traffic's going to be a mess, I don't want to worry with it. I still don't know that part. All I know is that he said one day, there's a sit-in downtown, we're not going down there.
Yeah.
And we never did again.
The book is Tracy Thompson. I'm talking with Tracy Thompson, whose new book is The New Mind of the South. And that puts us in mind of W.J. Cash's book, The Mind of the South, published in 1941. Hattie Carter, tell us about that book and the way it tried to retell or at least allow us to revision Southern history.
Well, to begin with, of course, Cash was a journalist, as we all are, and not actually a professional historian. Second, he was a Carolinian and a Piedmont Carolinian. And I was once at the 50th anniversary of the Mind of the South down at Wake Forest, and a notable historian got up and said, what is this white boy from this isolated section of one isolated state trying to talk about the Mind of the South? At which point the person sitting next to me wrote a note and saying, I guess what we need to do is confess that he was a white boy from an isolated section and go home. We have nothing left to talk about. The fact is, Cash was revolutionary at the time. The book was revelatory for many. It gave you a way to form a new matrix of how you looked at the South. But the thing I remember best about it has nothing to do with anybody else's memory, but it has a lot to do with many of the Southern traditions. It was the ability of the Southern white to come together in conformity when faced with the black threat. So old Colonel Jones could set out some theses to which the old private would say, yes, sir, because they had served together in defense of the indefensible and were now, in a hierarchical sense, still in the Confederate Army and in a class-ridden society that worked a lot. But it was a great, I say it to this moment, if you don't read The Mind of the South, you simply don't understand the evolution of the whole discussion, let alone some very wonderfully. The man, unfortunately, as most Carolinians know, committed suicide shortly thereafter of its publication, which, of course, every Southerner said was his absolute distraught understanding that he had been a traitor to his own region by what he wrote. That is not why.
And if you read it today, there are probably elements of it that would disturb the progressives among us because it did in some ways objectify the black story. It wasn't as subjective, but revolutionary certainly for its time because for the first time, point out that there were class distinctions in the South among whites and that yes, indeed, elite white cadres were taking full advantage of lower-class white folk and just telling them, lucky for you, you're not black.
Tracy, I'm reminded that you and I not only grew up many years apart, we grew up in different Souths.
Yes,
and
that's
home. I was just home from my, God forbid I should say this, my 60th high school reunion in Greenville, Mississippi. There are lots of Souths still. I just will just say that without going too much further. But the one thing that's unchanged about the South, and it's not a point that I think you necessarily agree with, come what may, we evolve even yet into a one-party system in which whites are in conformity and they rush ever more lemming-like to be in conformity. And we are now creating once again this one-party South for whites, which is so historically apt at its post-Civil War. What about that?
Yeah,
do you see that happening, Tracy?
I do. I don't disagree with that. But the thing that's striking about it to me is the kind of confluence of religion and politics in the South. It used to be that Southern evangelical religion was just everybody's religion, and you didn't politics did not really enter into it. And then came these big schisms in the Southern Baptist Convention and the Presbyterian Church in the 1970s and 80s. And suddenly, what we have now is a state where politics in the South is a whole lot more like religion, and religion is a whole lot more like politics. You can tell what somebody's politics are by what kind of church they go to. And that simply never was the case before.
Well, you know, there was a very good book written some time ago called The Church in Cultural Captivity by a Baptist who was afflicted by grief because what you are describing is happening in the post-Civil Rights era happened in spades in the 1830s and 40s when the evangelicals were assaulted and the essentially planter mentality about what church ought to represent won out, and the last chance for the church to speak as a social conscience sort of went down, way down the tube before the war ever before the Civil War even began. It's a book I recommend to everybody.
This is always, though, about who writes the history, what the narrative is, and you know, who the winners and losers is always about privilege. And for a long time, that was divided along racial lines in the South. But Tracy, you talk about the kind of homogenization of the South, it becoming more and more corporate, how Atlanta looks a lot more like the mollification of the South, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So the idea of how privilege is constructed and maintained has changed a little bit. And while race is still a factor, how much a part of that is now universal, a kind of an American political construct that allows more and more money to go to the top and fewer people to share the wealth, which is not necessarily entirely racially constructed or divided?
No, it has to do with this total veneration of property rights. Property rights rank paramount. They rank paramount over individual rights. They rank paramount over the community, the greater good of the community. And I think, I don't know if I'm qualified to say if that's unique to the South or not, but it's certainly been a major feature of Southern history. And in fact, I've just been reading some stuff on Reconstruction lately, and a big part of the problem with Reconstruction was that the freed slaves were making the argument that this land, we deserve to own a piece of this land. We own it from sweat equity. We have tilled it for generations. And that ran head on into the 19th century industrialist kind of concept of, yeah, but these other people have the deeds. You know, and so the beginnings of any kind of, you know, redistribution of land or whatever that might have happened in the South was nipped in the bud because white property owners still had the paperwork. And property rights were paramount.
You know, the other thing that got nipped in the bud repeatedly because a lot of us were defensive about making excuses for ourselves. But look, America was racist. America didn't give a damn about black people. It didn't give a damn before the Civil War. It didn't give a damn during the Civil War. And it certainly didn't after the Civil War. I mean, America in general abandoned them whenever possible and abandoned them for 100 years. So the South won the Civil War in the extent that it maintained serfdom for 100 years after supposedly losing the war. And why? Because of the rest of the country literally didn't give a damn. And then the country began to change its own views on the subject, and little by little it became intolerable that they weren't going to be as good as we were in the North, down
so
South.
So in that way, the industrial North emulated the South, and the South may have had a greater victory than we even imagined, given the way the redistribution of wealth.
We won the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, after the war, there were open conversations among, you know, the white aristocracy in the South of, okay, fine, they've emancipated the slaves. We can reinstitute it by other means,
you know. And those county jails were a big help. Tracy Thompson, thank you so much. New Mind of the South, author of that book. Howden Carter is a professor of leadership and public policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank both of you for being on the program.
It's great.
You're welcome.
Coming up next, we talk about spy crimes and whodunits with Jeffrey Deaver, the author of a new James Bond franchise. Stay tuned.